Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. If someone calls and says you're a jury duty no-show, there's something you should know. There's a lot of speculation about this Supreme Court's approach to the Civil Rights Act. Is it in jeopardy? And cupcakes and kids becomes an issue in the Illinois legislature. I'm Don Marsh, just some of the things to talk about with our legal roundtable panelists. Joining me in studio, attorneys Bill Freivogel. He directs the Journalism School at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Mark Smith is Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University, and he directs the Career Center there. Greg Majerian, Washington University Law Professor, joins us once again. Welcome back, Greg. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And Bill and Mark, nice to see you again.
Good morning.
Mark, I'll start with you because I know you and Bill have spent some time this morning at an American Bar Association meeting that's taking place here in St. Louis. What's going on there that would be of interest to our audience?
Well, it's a very interesting meeting and not one that I think has occurred before, or at least I don't know of it occurring. It was called Access Missouri, The Future of the Administration of Justice. It was put on by the American Bar Association, and apparently they're going to have about five or six of these meetings throughout the country in preparation for a national meeting to discuss the future of the profession. And it seemed to me, Bill and I were only able to stay an hour and a half, but it seemed that the things they were kind of concerned with was, one, the future of the profession in terms of training new lawyers and the idea that law school is not as attractive to many top students as it was 5-6 years ago. And that's I do pre-law advising. I see that all the time. We've got a lot less students applying to law school.
Because they're so expensive?
They're worried about the debt. They're worried about the possibility for jobs. They're just hearing horror stories from some lawyers about, well, this is not the life you want. So that was one thing. The perennial issue of access to justice and Bill knows the numbers, but I think it was something like 80% of poor and middle-class people are not getting legal help when they have a legal problem, and oftentimes they don't even know their problem is a legal problem. And then the last idea that I heard kind of come across was the idea that our government, with sequestration and other kind of cuts, has been cutting some of the funding for the judiciary and public defender's offices and the impact of that. And it was interesting because it was a relatively small group, but you had Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court, one of the federal district court judges. I saw a bankruptcy court judge there. So a couple of law faculty. So it was an interesting group. And Maury Poskover, who's very involved with the National ABA, he's a local attorney. And Bill Bay, who's also a local attorney, very active with the ABA. And I think they helped set it up. So I'm going to try and get back there this afternoon and find out more what's going on with it.
Bill, what did you take away from it?
Well, let's see. Mary Russell, on the first point that Mark mentioned. Mary Russell, the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court. On the first issue that Mark brought up about law student debt, she described law student debt these days as obscene. That's her word. And said that a lot of the law school graduates were either unemployed or underemployed, and that was a serious issue. She disclosed that she will from time to time put on her capris and her sandals and go sit in the corridors of a courtroom somewhere around Missouri to get an idea of what people are actually saying about their experience in the courtroom. I thought that was sort of interesting.
Is that supposed to make her inconspicuous?
I think that's supposed to make her inconspicuous.
I think that's great. The Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court is going around listening to how do people think our system's working, you know?
Yeah. One thing that worried me a little bit about what she said, but they really didn't go into too much detail, was that as people are able to get access to public court documents so easily in their home, should they be able to get access to everything that they can get if they have the energy to drive to the courtroom and actually ask for the file? She seemed to think that maybe there was an issue of privacy, that maybe you shouldn't be able to get all those documents at home. That sort of disturbed me a bit. They were talking about that 100 million people need access to a lawyer. Only about a quarter of them are actually getting it. They seem to be concerned that quite a few middle-class people were engaging in self-help, going to LegalZoom.com instead of to a lawyer, and that was a concern. Audrey Fleissig, the federal judge, was told about how they have a pro se In other words, getting legal help, a person who's not able to pay for legal help. They have a pro se filing system in the courthouse over here, the federal courthouse over here, that where they've actually put everything. They have even an e-pro se filing system, but not very many people are using it, partly because people who are filing pro se maybe don't know how to use the computers. Mm-hmm. So they were going to try to get some of the students from St. Louis University, where this conference is going on, to come on over from the clinics at St. Louis University and maybe help people file these kinds of complaints, many of which apparently are civil rights complaints. A lot of talk about the special courts, the drug courts, the mental health courts, the veterans courts that have been set up to provide sort of more specific kinds of justice and help from the courts.
Greg Majerian, does it catch you by surprise to hear that so many people have limited access to the legal system and the means to take advantage of it?
No, it doesn't catch me by surprise at all. I mean, obviously it's disappointing and it's not the state of the profession that we want, but the law gets more complicated all the time, and people live in that web. And the more difficulties and complications there are, the more need there is for lawyers. Economic inequality is growing. I'm glad to hear that the bar is wanting to take on this problem at a time when you could just be complaining about your own lot in life, and we're having a hard time getting clients, we're suffering. But I wonder whether the momentum. For that reason, whether the momentum of that initiative can really carry through. It's a challenge, but it's a very worthy one.
Well, like I said, they're going to do a few of these and then have the national one. So hopefully they'll get some momentum and keep it going. The other thing I thought was interesting, what Bill mentioned, this online forum. And on the one hand, there was some concern about online forums. And your listeners might say, oh, well, lawyers are worried that they're going to lose business. And the concern was not that, because in fact, the district court talked about all the resources they're putting online to help pro se, and that means a person who brings a case without a lawyer, pro se litigants. But I think they were worried that there's these materials online and people have a problem, and one, they may not realize it's a legal problem, or if they do realize it's a legal problem, they'll go to online forums and select the wrong legal solution to their problem, which is not going to solve it. And the fact that you need a lawyer sometimes to kind of say, okay, here's how we lawyers and how the courts are going to view your problem. So this is what you need to do. And they're just out there without this advice. And the courts can't give them that legal advice.
But this is Zoom.com that we're talking, or organizations like that. That's I've forgotten his first name, Shapiro, the lawyer in the O.J. Simpson case is running that. Is he not?
I think that's right. But they were pointing out that some of these online legal services aren't even connected really with lawyers. So that seemed to there's a self-interest issue, I think, also at work here. One interesting thing Judge Fleisig said was that one big problem the courts have is that people think that judges are just deciding things based on their political beliefs. Of course, as we have Supreme Court decisions where all the Republican appointed judges are voting one way and the Democratic justices another way, you can see how people might come to that conclusion, although it's certainly not always
right. Often
true.
We're going to get to that in a couple of minutes with regard to some reports indicating that the Supreme Court, in fact, is leaning so far right that the Civil Rights Act could be in jeopardy. But before we get there, I want to bring up a subject that a lot of people are talking about, and that's this fella, I think it's Cornelius Mike Anderson. He's the fella that was convicted of armed robbery about 13 years ago, sentenced to 13 years in prison, never served because he was never called to serve. And now he's in jail because they found him. He's lived an exemplary life, apparently, since he was convicted, raising a family of four kids. Good job. He's an ideal citizen from everything we've heard. Who and how can this be reversed? That's what people are responding to him and saying he shouldn't serve his time. Whether it's not up to us to decide that, but who would deserve? Greg, who would determine whether or not this guy actually has to?
Well, he could get a pardon from the governor, right? I mean, that would be.
Yeah, and politically, if the sentiments are strong enough in his favor, that could happen. But it is obviously a genuinely weird case, and it, you look at it in sort of simple legal terms, okay, it's a procedural problem. Like you said, they never called him to serve his term. And in some way, you could sort of say, well, the state just waives, you know, its authority to imprison him. But that seems like a bad idea to sort of establish as a precedent. I think sometimes we've got to recognize that strange cases fall between the cracks, and you have to just use a little common sense and look at what's in front of you. If you know, I could almost sort of imagine a fix to this somewhat like what at the federal level they're talking about with immigration, you know, require the guy to pay some sort of penalty or restitution, you know, so that he's not completely off the hook. But to take him, as you said, his exemplary life, to take him out of that, one thing this does is it kind of indicts in a very fundamental way the way we handle imprisonment. I mean, I'm not a criminologist, but young men commit crimes. I mean, that's the basic reality demographically. Young men commit crimes. And as we get older, all of us are men in this room, we just lose our energy for, you know, mayhem, I guess.
Anything,
And so, you know, a guy, other things being equal, a guy commits armed robbery at 20, give him a couple of breaks, and he's going to be a good citizen at 35. Now, what you do with that reality, I don't entirely know, but here it is in front of us.
You put him away for 13 years at age 20, and he would be coming out about now.
Yeah.
And chances are probably fairly heavy that he would go back to a life of crime.
Because it seems pretty clear that – I mean, I think people have given up – a lot of people have given up on the idea of rehabilitation in prison. Right. That, you know, it makes people recidivists. It hardens people.
Thoughts, Bill?
I thought the Missouri Attorney General Koster had a sensible sort of formulation, which was it had to be some sort of balance between the seriousness of his original crime, the clerical mistake that led to him not being incarcerated, and then his good conduct since he's in the past 13 years. And so, you know, I'm guessing he's not going to be serving anything like a 13-year sentence, but will have to spend – I take it he's in jail.
I think he is in jail. Yeah, they took him away. Right.
You know, so at some point they might just say time served, you were a good guy.
They being – who are they?
Well –
That's
why. See, I think the governor needs to do a pardon, and he's served some time, and he could say something like, you know, because of, like you said, for the time served and all these other factors, and we want to get him back with his family. And I don't think people would think that was unfair.
But otherwise, I think the state takes it back to court if they want to press the matter, and probably, you know, if they go to the extreme direction, they could accuse him of a further offense by not showing up to serve his time. And you know, it would be one thing if letting this guy off the hook was going to create an incentive for other people. But how do you create an incentive to do what?
What exactly?
To take advantage of clerical mistakes? I mean, who knows? This is just a quirk. It's just a straight-up quirk.
But he was not – it's not that he didn't show up to serve his time. It's that he wasn't summoned to serve his time.
Well, but in an extreme case, the state would say, look, the guy should, you know, come in on his own and say, my goodness, folks, I was convicted. I'm going to go to jail.
Yeah, you should put me in jail, right.
What human being does that?
Yeah, exactly.
But it was his lawyer who was telling him, don't do anything until they call you.
I guess his original lawyer is now retired, if I read it.
I think that's right.
And I guess his lawyer – could his lawyer go to court and for writ of habeas corpus? And
well, there was a reference in one of these about some Missouri case from like 1900 that had similar facts where they didn't make the person go. I didn't bother to read the case or anything because it's 100 years old. But so it sounds like his attorney has some type of legal argument that he shouldn't have to serve. But I agree with you. It's such a weird case that you just – to be a stickler about the law on this one just seems – like it doesn't serve justice.
It certainly has people talking. There's no question about that. I better take a break already. We'll do that and come back and continue with our legal roundtable discussion. Our panelists today, as usual, Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith. And also joining us for an encore performance is Greg Majerian from Washington University School of Law. Back in just a moment to continue the conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on legal issues in just a moment, but first here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The on-demand ride-sharing business known as Lyft is expected to be discussed in a St. Louis courtroom this afternoon. Lyft is an app-based business that operates not on rider fares but on donations. The St. Louis Metropolitan Taxicab Commission says the operation needs to be licensed and cannot operate without its approval. The agency is asking a judge today for an injunction to keep Lyft from operating in St. Louis. The St. Louis Zoo Museum District Board will meet this afternoon and is expected to discuss its response to Alderman Joe Rohde's critical report that identified problems with the district and with its operations. And some Illinois mayors say they'll be forced to raise property taxes or cut essential services if they don't get some pension relief. They're urging state lawmakers to make changes to pension systems for local police and fire departments. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. In view of those headlines and the situation with the Lyft taxi service, if that's what we can call it, Greg, you had made an interesting point before we went on the air about that and relating it to this cupcake situation in Illinois. The Illinois House has now approved legislation that would have allowed and would allow this sixth grader, this young lady who was baking cupcakes at home and selling them in the driveway or wherever, would allow her to do that. The health department says no, that she was not able to do that. What is your connection you're making between her case in Illinois and the Lyft case here?
Well, I should first say that it's you know, it's a hazy connection based on my usual hazy thinking. But the thing is, they're both situations where you've got a regulatory authority claiming dominion or jurisdiction over some manner of sub-professional or non-professional operation. And it raises a very interesting and important question in both cases, which is why do we license and regulate professional services? And at what point and in what ways do our reasons for licensure really kick in and not kick in? So, you know, the cupcake thing is an extreme. It's a lemonade stand. It's a bake sale kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain common sense starting point where you say, okay, we don't regulate that like we regulate a commercial bakery. But then you move a little bit down the spectrum and you say, well, why? You really have to ask that interesting hard question about what, you know, and the public health people say, look, there at least has to be, there's an amendment to the bill, I believe, that came in the Illinois legislature. There at least has to be an allowance for allowing people to bring complaints, allowing there to be restrictions when there's some sort of outbreak of disease, which seems entirely sensible. But it's brought the legislation sort of to focus on what's really important about licensure there. Yeah.
In this particular case, the points of the bill that has passed the House, not yet the Senate, in order to qualify as a home kitchen, monthly gross sales cannot exceed $1,000. Food cannot be potentially hazardous. That makes sense. And the operator must provide notice to the purchaser that the items are home-baked.
But I think this issue of licensure, what's the purpose of it? On the one hand, it's always justified is we need to protect the public. So we license doctors to protect the public health. So we have, you know, people who are good doing these procedures. But the second benefit of the licensure, of the restricting, is it restricts the supply and raises the price. And nobody ever talks about that, but I think a lot of times there are licensures out there that you have to wonder, are we really doing this for the public? So with taxis, I'm sure there's some public safety issues. I want to get in a cab that I know is not going to fall apart. But I've been in cabs in other cities where I had serious concerns that they would fall apart. And I suspect it's much more about protecting, a monopoly to allow people to charge what they want and have less competition.
There can be a lot of money involved here, too, because I'll give an example, a personal example. It's not from St. Louis, but it's from San Francisco. A month ago, I took a cab from the San Francisco airport to Palo Alto. It cost me $125. A mutual friend of ours, Martha Shirk, said, hey, on the way back, you should call up Uber. You should get Uber. This sort of taxi service on your cell phone and just call for a car. I did, and I could see there was a little map showing how the car was approaching, and it cost $45 so to get back to the airport from Palo Alto. So it's a lot less expensive.
That obviously has appeal.
We should also note, in fairness, that this argument about keeping the supply low and the demand high certainly gets made with lawyers.
Lawyers all the time, right.
Because lawyers are contentious, and people who want to compete with lawyers are equally contentious. So,
right.
All right.
So, you know, all of our oxes are gored by this.
Yeah, exactly. Now,
very quickly, let's just deal with this. The revision of the criminal code in the state of Missouri is moving along very quickly. It looks like it's a version is going to get to the governor, and the governor is indicating that he's probably not going to sign it because it's too big. Well, isn't a revision of a criminal code by definition going to be
And it also sounds like there's been some suggestion, well, we may not have worked everything out properly, but we can fix it as it goes, or we can delay it for 2 years. I think part of the concern is some of the big drivers of this, the change to the Senate and the House, are going to be having to retire. They're at the end of their terms. And the governor has said, no, I want it to be fixed, and I want it to be fixed right. And I don't really get it. I mean, it seems like this is a tough thing to get through. It needs to be done. I would love it to be perfect, too, but I'm just not sure that you can guarantee that. So maybe this is just his way of signaling, I want you to take a really hard look at this and do a better job than you've done so far. I don't know.
But they've been doing this for a legislative session after session.
They've been working on it for years. It's a bipartisan effort.
Yeah.
He's not raising any specific objections that I've seen to any particular provision. And so it comes down to a bet that the status quo ante is better than the attempt to reform it. And I think when you talk about criminal law, that's a terrible bet.
Right.
All right. Well, it's not a done deal yet, but that seems to be the way that it is going. One or two other things quickly, because there's some things nationally that I want to get to that are very, very important. I want to mention, and I think this is just for the purposes of letting our audience know people who don't know about this jury scam in the city of St. Louis. You've been hearing about this. Bill, why don't you explain what that's about?
Well, it seems as though some people who have not shown up for jury duty have gotten a call telling them they'll be arrested unless they go out and get a prepaid credit card and call back to pay a fine. And so people go out and get this prepaid credit card, call back all the numbers, and then apparently the scammers can then change even the amount can change the amount after they've gotten those numbers. You can't for failing. Apparently, the way the procedure is supposed to work when it's the legal legitimate procedure is you get a notice. If you don't show up, you get a second notice. Then there's a third notice, and then you actually could be arrested or fined. But these people, this scam is totally unrelated to the legitimate purpose. And so if you get a call and they tell you to go get yourself a credit card to pay the fine, do not do it.
And the police department does not do that, not make calls. It's very, very simple. Yeah, be very, very wary of calls like that. Okay, let's move along now. I saw this report in CNN, and I'm guessing that you guys did too, suggesting that the Civil Rights Act, now 50 years old exactly, is in some jeopardy because of the right-leaning U.S. Supreme Court. We've got five justices considered quite conservative. And basically, they have, on decisions involving race, they have made very, very conservative rulings. Justice Kennedy, who is generally regarded as the swing vote in the court, has never voted to uphold affirmative action, from what I understand. So this begs the question, is the Civil Rights Act in jeopardy? Greg?
Well, I guess first we have to sort of focus in on what we're talking about. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 has a lot of different provisions with different legal groundings, dealing with things ranging from employment discrimination to discrimination in provision of essential public services. Let me start by saying I'm very concerned about the tenor and nature of the Supreme Court, especially on race. Justice Kennedy, on issues of racial discrimination across the board, has never been remotely progressive. That is one issue on which Justice O'Connor was a true swing vote, and Justice Kennedy was and is not. I'm worried about the Voting Rights Act, but as far as the Civil Rights Act is concerned, yeah, I'd say my general antennae are up, but I don't see a present threat. I think, you know, just more of a general concern with any racial question, affirmative action you mentioned, you know, with this current Supreme Court, you really have to be concerned.
Mm-hmm. Bill?
I mean, they already have cut back, as Greg was saying, on at least they've made it more difficult to justify affirmative action, saying that you have to prove, you know, saying in that Texas case, was it last year, that you had to prove that there was no better way of getting diversity than the plus that you've given to a minority. But they also, you know, there was a Seattle school desegregation case a few years ago where they said that you can't have race in assignments if there's not a past civil rights violation. But like Greg, I don't see them saying that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is out, or even undercutting it in the same kind of way in which they undercut the Voting Rights Act last year. They're not going to suddenly say restaurants and swimming pools you can discriminate against, you know, blacks and not allow them in any longer. That's not going to happen.
Here's an example of something you could imagine happening. So the arguments have been made among academics and occasionally in court for a long time that some employment discrimination provisions should be struck down because they violate free speech or free association rights. So things like creating a hostile work environment comes up in gender cases more than race cases. That argument has never really gotten traction. And you could imagine this majority – just based on their ideology and their basic ideals going that direction. But I haven't seen a bit of it yet. And you know, the one – to the extent we don't like what the Supreme Court is doing at any point in time, the one defense that you have or the one firewall that you have is that they have to worry about political capital as well. And with race cases, even this majority has had to tread somewhat more carefully than in other subjects where they have strong views and want to make changes.
Well, I read this article, the CNN report, and one of the things they were talking about was the Supreme Court cutting back on disparate impact cases. And just so your listeners understand, when there's race discrimination cases, there's two broad categories. There's disparate treatment. So I don't hire you because you're African-American. That's the reason I hire you, and we proved that. That's a disparate treatment case. A disparate impact is, and let's turn it to sex. I say my secretary needs to do 100 push-ups as to qualify for the job, and we can prove that, you know, 20% of men can do it, but only 5% of women can do it, and it doesn't relate to the job. There's no heavy lifting in the job. Well, that would be a disparate impact. The criteria is neutral, but it has a disparate impact on a particular protected class. And they point to that New Haven firefighter case. But when, as I remember that case, they said, well, they didn't prove that the test had a disparate impact. So, I'm a little concerned about it too, but not that concerned.
Well, and issues like that, there was a case last year, and there have been other cases, you know, statutory interpretation cases where they've tightened and made it more difficult to bring certain kinds of lawsuits.
Right.
And those are bad rulings, but they don't go to the heart of the legality or constitutionality of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah. And God forbid, Mark, that anybody should ever ask me to do 100 push-ups.
Yeah, I'm right there.
For any reason.
I mean, I think there's really been a verdict of history on the Civil Rights Act, that it's one of the most important laws that's been passed. I mean, 50 years ago, we didn't have it. It occurred 50 years ago this coming summer.
Yeah.
And there's been some really interesting retrospectives on how that all got passed.
By a majority of Republicans.
A lot of Republicans.
Correct? Yeah. More Republicans than Democrats.
I'm wondering how the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act is going to go next year. Because I would say the same – I think you're absolutely right, Bill. I would say the same thing about the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
And it's shameful what this court has done on voting rights.
Well, while we're on this subject, we have a call from Scott in Chesterfield who wants to talk about affirmative action. Scott, go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, regarding the testing aspect, IQ tests have been rising, or IQ test scores have been rising worldwide faster than can be explained by evolution. That's according to the Flynn effect. And what that means to me is that you can't use these tests to determine somebody's potential or capability. So just because someone doesn't do good on a test doesn't mean they couldn't be Colin Powell someday or Condoleezza Rice. So, you know, so that's just what I wanted to say in defense of affirmative action and you know.
Okay, Scott. Thank you for the call. Any?
I hadn't realized that that was the case. I wish if it is the case, I wish people would start making smarter decisions worldwide. At any rate, I think he's right. I mean, there have been in some of these cases that say involve firefighters. You know, there have been the courts have said, well, you can't just totally rely on a pen and pencil test. You got to have something that compares what they're doing to the job performance factors. So, in a lot of these cases. That kind of thing has been taken into account. Yeah,
and I think the broader point is interesting. I mean, we tend to have these very comfortable notions about meritocracy, you know, that in general the best people rise to the top. And I'd sort of look at the inverse of that. When the people rising to the top are generally people who look like us in this room, you know, and that's just statistically unlikely. And there's likely a better explanation for it, and affirmative action properly designed is one way to try to address that problem.
I see it with I have a son who's a senior in high school, you know, getting ready to go to college. And, you know, and I come from a blue-collar family, so my dad didn't get out of high school. I took the SAT once. I worked hard in high school because I wanted to have a better job. I wanted to, you know, sit and work inside instead of outside like my dad did. But I got very lucky. My son, though, my wife and I are like on him all the time about his grades and about how many times you need to take the ACT, and we're going to take this prep course. And this is, you know, this is very important. And I don't think other kids always get that. So I think that's why a lot of times the people in the room look like us, because you've got these people who get lucky. I was one of those. But for the most part, it's people who've got parents who are just on their case all the time.
And some of the prep course, I mean, that's money too.
Well,
and
yeah,
that's,
it's
and
very
that's,
expensive.
That's a huge deal.
Yeah, it's hugely expensive.
Well, we're already at our second break time. Let's do that now and come back and continue the conversation more on the Supreme Court and other local issues as well. This is our Legal Roundtable Day. With me in studio is Greg Majerian from Washington University, Mark Smith from Washington University, and Bill Freivogel from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Back to continue in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our Legal Roundtable discussion today. Gentlemen, we talked about this before going on the air, and it excited some comment. Let's just get some of that out on the table here. Justice Stevens, retired, has written a book called Six Amendments, just coming out. He said that we need changes in our Constitution and amendments in particular. He recites the anti-commandeering rule, gerrymandering, campaign finance, sovereign immunity, the death penalty, and gun control. It's controversial, but what is the significance of a retired justice commenting on these kinds of issues? Greg?
Well, first I got to start by saying that I had the insane good fortune to clerk for Justice Stevens about 20 years ago, so I am not unbiased on this subject. I revere him. I think he's taking the opportunity as someone who's not sitting on the bench but who's thought through a lot of these problems over many decades to just try to lay out very bluntly what he thinks some of the essential structural constitutional problems are. And proposing a constitutional amendment or a set of constitutional amendments, it's really hard to amend the Constitution now. I mean, harder than I think the framers ever envisioned that it would be. So to do what he's doing is to use that device to start a conversation. It's not a practical political call to arms. It's, hey, let's really think. And other academics have done this, but it carries a lot more cachet when a Supreme Court justice says, let's open up the hood of the Constitution, get down into the workings and really see what we're dealing with and what some of the problems are.
Any other thoughts, gentlemen?
Well, I think a lot of Justice Stevens also. He was appointed. He was a Republican appointee. I think Gerald Ford's appointee to the Supreme Court. He, as time went on, began to be classified as more of a liberal justice. He's 94 years old, but amazingly, with it, he still plays tennis. Apparently, I just saw him give a speech about a month and a half ago. You know, very sharp. These six constitutional amendments, I think the Constitution would probably be better if his amendments passed, even if I don't agree with every one of them. I'd be scared at opening up the hood, as Greg sort of used that analogy, and making changes to the Constitution, because I have a feeling it wouldn't be Justice Stevens' proposals that would get adopted. I don't think any of his proposals will be adopted. These are things where he sort of lost on the Supreme Court, most of them. Campaign finance, for example.
Right.
Guns. In both those cases, he was a – I mean, he didn't think that campaign finance money was speech, and he thought that guns were for militias, and that's a way he would amend the Second Amendment to make clear that that's what it's supposed to do.
Well, I'll show my stupidity here. What is the anti-commandeering rule?
Well, that related to guns too. I mean, it was one of the reasons that part of the Brady Bill was thrown out. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Greg, but my recollection is that they said, well, the Brady Bill sort of commandeered local sheriffs to enforce part of that law, and that was like commandeering a state official to give them federal orders, and that you couldn't do that.
That's right. And it's more broad than that particular issue. There were other cases on it as well. But the idea, the current Supreme Court, and this has been true for a couple of decades now, has the view that there are limits on the ability of the federal government to enlist state government officials to carry out federal policy. And that's an innovation of the last starting in 1990, I guess. It's a principle that had never really been articulated before that. And Justice Stevens and others on the court who opposed that move over time, I think, still think it's an important mistake.
Mark, your thoughts about
the
justice?
These guys know it better than me. I think they did a good job.
Well, one of the things that he would like to change is the way we finance campaigns, and we've discussed this on many levels on this program. And I know Bill and Greg, both of you, have written about this, the so-called McCutcheon ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court just a couple of weeks ago. Well, here we are again. What do you make of this ruling following Citizens United, which declared that corporations and unions are basically people?
I think McCutcheon is an even bigger deal than Citizens United was.
And would you just explain the essence of that ruling for me?
McCutcheon struck down what are called the aggregate campaign contribution limits in federal law. So basically in federal law, there are two ways in which you're restricted in how much you can contribute to federal campaigns. There's a limit to how much you can contribute to any one particular candidate or political committee within a two-year cycle. And then there's also a restriction on how much you total as a contributor can give to all of the candidates and committees that you want to donate to. McCutcheon strikes down the latter of those two restrictions. Now, as a practical matter, it isn't going to affect a great many people. And right now, the so-called base limits, the limits of how much you can give to a particular candidate, remain in effect. The reason this decision, in my view, is such a big deal is that although Chief Justice Roberts in his opinion for the court sort of says, oh, yeah, we've got the base limits. They take care of whatever problems they are. Don't worry about it. The base limits are there. If you read the opinion carefully, his logic completely undermines the legal justification for the base limits as well as the aggregate limits that get struck down. So it is – I mean, if you want to make money – take a bet on whether the Supreme Court's going to strike down the base limits, barring a change in the court's personnel. That's the next case. It's going to happen. It's going to happen within 2 or 3 years.
The base limits being the like, 50, is it $5,200? Yeah,
26 per election.
For an election cycle, yeah. I mean, Greg.
But it would be 52.
Well, 52
because you get the primary
and
the general.
Right. Yeah, so you double it.
So if you think about – I mean, the aggregate – one way to think about this aggregate contribution level is think about Rex Singfield. I mean, this case didn't involve him directly, but it was sort of Alabama's version of Rex Singfield, who wants to give a lot of money to a lot of different candidates, and there's more ability to do this. Some people have said, well, there's actually a positive impact in that it will enable political parties to be more active than, say, these super PACs that have grown up. And so that will strengthen the hand of political parties. Political parties are generally a more moderating influence than the super PACs, and so maybe it won't be so bad. But I mean, Greg had a good quote that I used from him saying that he thought Citizens United was the pod and McCutcheon, this aggregate decision, was the mothership. So the Supreme Court is basically saying you've got to have a lot better reason than we've said in the past for any kind of campaign, any kind of contribution limit. You have to show quid pro quo.
Yeah.
It's not enough to say somebody's buying influence. You have to say they're buying influence and they're sort of getting something in return.
You got to show they're bribing.
And you know, for 40 years we've had this sort of Solomonic bargain in campaign finance law, even as the court has been doing in cases like Citizens United for a long time, has been – allowing the floodgates of spending in campaigns to remain completely open, there's been this relatively broad allowance for the federal government and states to limit how much people and entities can contribute in campaigns, because the reasoning is that contribution level is where corruption really happens. You know, if you can give an unlimited amount of money to a candidate, you can buy that candidate. And the Supreme Court has now basically said exactly as Bill just said, the limit, that logic only applies to the extent we're talking about basically, well, as you said, basically a bribe. And you know, we've got bribery laws. So the writing is on the wall for the campaign finance laws.
The other, I think, immediate impact of this is bundlers. So the way bundling works is, so we're three rich guys, and we want to give to a bunch of candidates. Bill picks out his candidates. I pick out mine. Greg picks out his. And we all agree that we're going to give the max to each of them. So we basically triple the amount we can give to our candidates by giving it to their candidates as well. And so this is, you know, there used to be this limit on the bundlers. Now there's no limit.
Well, Justice Stevens, promote your book very well, and perhaps people will rethink some of this campaign financing stuff, because it certainly is a disproportionate situation where the little guy is really not much of a factor when it comes to...
It's tough with this campaign finance, though, because money's like water, and it just flows to the candidates. And I don't know, I mean... I think it's difficult to come up with a good solution for this.
I think that's right. And I think that's the you know, for people like me who think that campaign finance rules are both constitutional and desirable, I think that's the best caution that, you know, if you're going to do something, you got to do something that's going to work. But I think in an ideal world, we would have a legal regime, a constitutional regime that allowed Congress to do what it tried to do in the wake of Watergate that started this whole legal progress and say, let's be comprehensive here. Let's look at the whole landscape, look at the way that people use money and do the best we can. It's like healthcare. I mean, of course, it's an intractable problem, but you can do something if you've got the legal capacity to at least address the problem comprehensively. And Congress hasn't had that power really for 40 years.
I thought Chief Justice Roberts did have a point, though, when he said, if the First Amendment protects flag burning and funeral protests and Nazi parades, why doesn't it protect this?
Apples and oranges. you're kind. I'm not feeling kind this morning.
Another issue here dealing with the Supreme Court, that apparently a lot of states are having some difficulty with the same-sex marriage situation because of a Supreme Court decision which said that federal authorities must recognize same-sex unions performed in states where they are legal. States are trying to figure all of this out. What is their problem?
You know, it's funny. We're just talking about campaign finance, and I'm always, you know, criticizing, as in this case with voting rights, saying, man, this court, Chief Justice Roberts, they're so clever. They go incrementally. They make, you know, one move that sets up the next move. And I'm always being critical of that. And with same-sex marriage, they're kind of doing exactly the same thing, and I love it. So I'm a hypocrite. The basic issue is that in this Windsor case, recent decision, the Supreme Court struck down, as most people know, big provisions of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And the underlying reasoning for doing that was you can't pass a law just because you have something against gays and lesbians. And that's what DOMA and the Supreme Court's view was. And so now state judges looking – or federal judges looking at different sort of state restrictions on same-sex marriage. And DOMA was not a same-sex marriage case. It was not about marriage. But judges are looking at these laws and saying, well, why did states pass these laws? Why did states amend their constitutions? And the answer really in these cases is because they had something against gays and lesbians getting married. And so the court, you know, the judges are, well, okay, do we make the leap from Windsor to saying that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage when the Supreme Court hasn't made that leap yet? Mm-hmm. But it's awfully, you know, the runway is lighted for that approach.
I think the Supreme Court probably thought it had managed to dodge that sort of really fundamental question when they, you know, at the same time as they did the Defense of Marriage Act, the decision they sort of avoided the Prop 8 California law against same-sex marriage. But I think things are really moving faster than almost anybody, probably including they, thought they would. So you've got judges in Utah, Virginia, Oklahoma, Texas, and Michigan who have said that those states' prohibitions against same-sex marriage probably violate the rationale that the Supreme Court has put forward. And then you've got a second tier of cases, Tennessee, Ohio, and Kentucky, that says those states have to recognize same-sex marriages from other states where they were properly performed. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to the DOMA case, the Windsor case that Greg was talking about, I mean, there's something in there for both sides. On the one hand, Kennedy said, well, marriage is basically the province of the states. So, from that, you might say, well, then states get to have laws against same-sex marriage. But on the other hand, he had language like that the federal law demeans same-sex couples, makes same-sex marriage unequal, humiliates tens of thousands of children living in same-sex families by treating persons as living in marriage as less respected than others. It violates basic due process and equal protection. Well, I mean, if he meant that, then how can you actually have state laws against same-sex marriage?
And that language is not equivocal. And it also follows – Justice Kennedy – it's interesting. Justice Kennedy is not very at all progressive on racial issues, as I was saying before, but he has been the leading architect of the court's rulings tearing down discrimination against gays and lesbians. He's written three important opinions, and it's almost a Groundhog Day thing where every 10 or 15 years he gets one of these cases, writes this opinion that's somewhat – Delphic or cryptic, but very, very, forceful in its effect. Justice Kennedy writes this Justice Scalia writes this enraged dissent. These guys could practically have a macro for these opinions now. But the opinions are about the government can't demean, to use the word that you just quoted, same-sex marriage, gays and lesbians, and that applies to same-sex relationships. I think – I'm not so sure that the court didn't know exactly what they were doing. I think they dodged the Prop 8 case because they didn't want on the first pass before the Supreme Court to have to say, okay, we hereby say that throughout the country, they're letting it go state by state. It's moving fast, but public opinion is shifting fast as well. And I think when the Supreme Court gets this next year, even that – couple of years passage of time, they're going to be in a much more secure place and from which they can sort of issue and sell a decision that there's a constitutional right to same-sex marriage.
I want to take another call as time will allow here because Bob in Millstatt, Mark, I think wants to raise an issue that you raised. Bob in Millstatt, go ahead.
The other day I was watching a PBS program on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They bring together corporations and legislators, and they present them with draft copies of legislation, which oftentimes is introduced as a bill, almost word for word. My question was, what constitutes evidence in court of bribery? In other words, is it a preponderance of evidence? Is it most probable? What a reasonable person would constitute? I don't understand that. And then I had another one that was on the Nevada rancher.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Bob. We just don't have time to get in both of these, and our time is limited here. Do you want to take the bribery?
I don't think that would be evidence of bribery. You have to have a legislator. It's got to be, I'm giving you this money, and I expect you to vote this way. And the legislature says, I will vote that way for your money. But I think there all the time you have I mean, when I was a lawyer, I drafted legislation that our clients thought would solve a problem, and they would go to a legislator and say, this will solve our problem and it'll help your district. But it wasn't, you got to be pretty – and these cases are saying quid pro quo.
Another thing for you, we have a note here that you mentioned earlier on with the ABA meeting here about what would be a legal problem that people don't realize is a legal problem? You said that was one of the issues that came up, but I need a quick answer on that.
I mean, I can think of a lot of things, but say I've got maybe I've got an incapacitated relative, and I'm paying out all this money for their care, and I don't realize that we could go and get some kind of government assistance if instead of me paying out the money, and then I could do something else. I don't know. That's probably not the best example. But there are also situations where maybe you got – do you have one?
I think they actually mentioned one as a number of them being healthcare related. You could have a number. And certainly, estate planning, end-of-life issues. There's all sorts of
care. Or I get denied my Social Security benefits because I'm disabled. Right. I don't realize I have a right to appeal that.
Yeah. Okay. We only have a minute left, and I did want to acknowledge the passing a couple of weeks ago of State Representative Rory Ellinger. He was a frequent caller to this program, by the way.
And a guest on the program.
Any thoughts very, very quickly? This guy was the quintessential liberal, I guess.
He was just a very gentle, kind man. I didn't know him well, but I just so much enjoyed
Rory was my friend, actually my wife's second cousin, and he got a great gift, though, you know, at the end of his life. He always wanted to be an elected official, and he got that opportunity. And not only did he get that opportunity, but then as the most liberal member of the Missouri legislature, he was able to be respected across the aisle in a way that doesn't happen that awfully much these days. And it was really, really very wonderful. I'm going to miss expecting one of the calls that comes into this program to be from Rory.
We'll miss those calls. I was surprised to learn. I didn't know that for a brief period of time he was a bodyguard for Martin Luther King.
I was surprised,
I'm
too.
I'm kind of surprised by that.
Wow.
We've got to leave it at that. And you've just been hearing from Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith, our regulars on the Legal Roundtable panel, Greg Majerian, also with us from Washington University. Thank you for being with us. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about French King Louis IX, the only French king to be canonized. The 800th anniversary of his birth is later this week, and we'll talk about his role in society and why French settlers named our city after him. We'll talk with Belleville native Ted Trent about a new movie he produced and stars in. It's called Belleville, the Movie. St. Louis on the Air is a presentation of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.